Court is ready to hear argument in 040662 Siegel Energy E&P versus Eland Energy Inc.
Good morning. I'm Bill Maines. My colleague Bill Boyce and I represent Siegel Energy Exploration and Production, which is now through a series of acquisitions part of Devon Energy Corporation. Siegel was the operator of the offshore wells, which are the subject of this dispute. Eland was a participating interest owner in these wells and one of the defendants in the trial court below. We're here today presenting the court with a very narrow issue. And the issue is this. Once Eland assigned its interests to Nortex, did Eland remain liable under the operating agreements when Nortex defaulted in its obligation to pay its proportionate share of certain costs and expenses?
Why wouldn't it be?
We believe it is. We believe it is.
Because of the contractual language?
The Court of Appeals held that it was not. We believe this was error because the contract does not expressly provide in the cost sharing provision or in the assignment provision. It does not contain the express words that there is continuing liability after an assignment of a participating interest. That was the basis of the Court of Appeals opinion, and we believe that was error.
There seems to be a good bit of disagreement about what really happens out there. Why is that?
Because this doesn't happen very often. As a general rule, particularly in the offshore, because these projects are so expensive to drill and so expensive to explore and develop, it is rare, and this was one point that the parties did agree on about what really happens out there during the trial court proceedings, it is rare for a participating interest owner to default in performance. Our witnesses we presented said that. Mr. Allen, the co-owner of Eland, admitted that that is, or indicated that that is also the case in his experience. It's a rare occurrence, and this goes to the issue of whether or not there is a custom and practice with respect to what happens here. And our position is, first of all, that there is not. It was undisputed that this doesn't happen very often. And second, at the very best, the evidence at trial indicated that our client, Siegel, when it issues joint interest billings, looks to current interest owners to pay. But there's nothing extraordinary about that. That's nothing more than general business practice that companies expect their people with whom they do business to pay their debts when they're due.
But that's what the Court of Appeals said. That's what the Court of Appeals said, isn't it? You look at the contract. The contract says the owners pay. The owners are the ones you bill.
That was the basis of the Court of Appeals ruling, yes. That was the basis of the
Because that's what the contract said.
Because the contract does not expressly state that there is continuing liability, but it also doesn't expressly state that there is not continuing liability.
But it does specify who pays.
It specifies that current interest owners pay current joint interest billings, but it does not speak directly to what happens when there is a default after an assignment.
Is it going to create problems with these contracts and assignability if there is a clause in there saying if you once an assignee, always responsible?
It will not. And there is no issue here about the validity of the assignments. The operating agreements are assignable.
My question was, does it create a problem in the industry if that clause is inserted into the contract so that someone who purchases, takes an assignment, can read in there and says, if you take this assignment, you're always going to be liable from here on out? Does that create problems with the industry?
It should not create problems with the industry. It shouldn't limit the ability of a current interest owner to assign its interest as long as it assigns its interest to a financially responsible party. And companies deal with this in a couple of different ways.
But my question is that if the industry reads the Court of Appeals opinion well written, isn't that going to be the requirement from now on? If you want someone to be liable from now on, you have to say so in the agreement so they can read it and find out what obligation they're assuming. Wouldn't that be the net effect in the industry to put one of those clauses in there?
The better practice would be to express that requirement in words in the contract, yes. Our position is that it's not required for that language to be there because that's what the law requires. That's what Restatement Section 318.3 requires. That's what the five Court of Appeals cases that we've cited to the court have held consistently. I want to follow up on the point you're making, though, about the assignment, because we're not challenging the validity of the assignment. We're not trying to create a rule that does restrict the assignability of interests. We're only asking the court to apply the restatement view and the common law view that there is continuing liability absent an agreement otherwise or a release or discharge by the original obligee to the contract. And we're not asking the court to create any kind of implied covenant that serves to restrict the assignability. We agree that assignability is a good thing and that if companies want to assign their interests and they believe that that's in their best commercial interest, they should be able to do so. The theory of our case has always been, though, that under the restatement view and under the cases that we cited to the court, there is continuing liability after a party assigns its contractual rights. And we see this in the 718 Associates versus Sunwest case in the landlord-tenant context. We see this in Jones versus Cooper in the case of the assignment of patent rights. We see this in an older case called Potts versus Burkett in the context of a sale for oil and gas. The Court of Appeals never really reached this point, and this was really the heart of our theory of the case, but the Court of Appeals never reached that point because it concluded two things. First, the Court of Appeals concluded that since the agreements did not expressly provide for continuing liability, then there should not be continuing liability. But in addition, the Court of Appeals concluded, and this is really, I think, what Elan's argument is, and they say this plainly on page 32 of their brief, once you're no longer an owner, you have no liability. And this is where we believe the Court of Appeals went astray. That is not what the contract says. Under Article, the two relevant provisions here are Article 8 and Article 14. Article 8 merely indicates that participating interest owners share costs in proportion to their participating interests. All Article 8 does is sets out the manner in which the costs are allocated. Article 14 deals with the issue of costs for abandonment, well abandonment, and platform removal liabilities. But the operating agreements are silent as to what happens with respect to costs once there's been an assignment. So the issue becomes, which way does the silence cut? And our position is that the silence is answered by the restatement view, which is that there is continuing liability absent release or an agreement otherwise by the original obligee to the contract, the operator, and by Texas case law, which holds to the same effect.
I mean, doesn't silence have to incorporate whatever the general rule of law is?
Yes, it does.
You can't expect contracting parties to say, and oh, by the way, we incorporate this rule, this rule, this rule.
And that is exactly what Texas law is, Your Honor. That is the law that this is described.
Doesn't have to be.
It is Texas. It's the law everywhere. That rule has been stated in Texas in Wesley Energy versus Jennings with respect to rules applicable to bank deposits. And the rule is stated in McCreary versus Bay Area Bank and Trust with respect to the coverture laws, the laws that require husbands to consent to conveyances of property by their wives when those laws were constitutional. Of course, they're not any longer. But the parties do not have to state in writing what the law requires. The last point that I wanted to address is the suggestion that there's never a way to terminate liability, which is plainly not the case. This is a position that Eland has taken over the course of the case, and that's just not the case under the operating agreements. And there are two examples where the operating agreements do show us how liability can terminate. The first is in Section 14.3, which deals with where a party does not consent to participating in a particular well. At that point, the party is entitled to assign its interest in that well to the parties who do want to participate in the well, and if there's any liability, it has to pay the liability that may exist with respect to the well. But if at that point it is released, and the Article 14.3 expressly states that under those circumstances there is no liability as to that well. And more important is, I think, Article 15.1. We've talked about that in the brief, and it has to do with where a party wants to actually withdraw from the operating agreement. And there's a calculation that is set forth in that article, and if the party wants to withdraw and it turns out that it owes money for future P&A costs and plant dismantling and removal costs, it writes a check to the operator, and at that point it is released from further liability under the clear terms of the agreement. We'd like to reserve the rest of our time for rebuttal. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. The court is ready to hear argument from the respondent.
May it please the court, Mr. Carl D. Rosenblum will present argument for the respondent.
Good morning, Your Honor. Mr. Chief Justice, members of the court, may it please the court. The issue here is simply about risk allocation. This is a typical oil and gas contract dispute. It arises under standard joint operating agreements. Very importantly, Your Honors, it does not involve the relationship between a lessee and a lessor. There is no lessor involved in this case. This is simply a dispute among co-lessees, or more appropriately, a former co-lessee, my client Eland Energy, and Siegel, a co-lessee. This dispute concerns the liability for plugging, abandonment, and salvage costs, all arising after July 1, 1996. There is no issue that when Eland was an owner, when it was a participating interest owner up to July 1 of 1996, that Eland paid all of its share of costs. The issue is, post July 1, 96, once Eland became a former working interest owner, or more appropriately under the specific provisions of the operating agreement, the express language, a former participating interest owner.
Why wouldn't any owner, rather than go through the withdrawal provisions of the agreement, Section 15, I think it is, simply sell their interest as this was done in this case to avoid any further liability, not have to pay their proportionate share of costs? Why wouldn't all of them do that?
Why would any owner do it? It would depend upon the circumstance at the time. Eland clearly paid all of its obligations up to July 1 of 96. If the court is aware, I provided some bench exhibits. Perhaps the last tab will be more directly on point. The last tab is a pie chart, and it clearly shows that once Eland sold this interest, and I can't emphasize enough that these interests were sold at an auction where it was a blind, no minimum bid. Eland certainly hoped it got more than the consideration it received. And what happened, it shows that there was more production after it sold its interest than while it owned it. The slice of the pie chart that's in yellow is the amount of production when Eland owned the interest. The slice that's in blue is post-assignment. So at the time, Eland chose to assign it. And Siegel tells you today, Your Honor, that they freely want and promote free assignments. Siegel does it all the time. It is common practice in the industry. At the time, under the circumstance, the party intending to transfer out its interest would decide whether or not It thought it could get more for its value, for its interest at the time, by setting it at an auction, as was done here, or deciding to withdraw at the time. So it would really depend upon the circumstance, if I'm answering your question.
It was a gamble, you're saying.
Excuse me, Your Honor?
It's a gamble?
In this case, it was somewhat of a gamble to Eagle, because they certainly hoped that they would have received more consideration for selling the properties. They did it at a blind, no minimum bid auction, which happens all the time. Obviously, when they found out that it was sold to Nortex and sold for the consideration it was sold for, particularly in hindsight, Your Honor, looking at the amount of production that came out after the assignment, their gamble didn't go the right way. But the important point is that the language of the operating agreement is what sets out the risk allocation between the parties.
And to take, just before we get off that subject, to take the hardest case, and there are four working interest owners. One of them's the operator. And they're all sitting there watching the deal play out. And the three say, you know, one of these days we're going to have to plug all these wells, and it's going to be a bunch of money. And why don't we get out now while the getting's good? We'll assign our interest to some shell company that doesn't have any assets. And stick our brother, the operator, with the closing out expenses when it comes time to close all these wells, plug all these wells. What's the response to that?
These are federal leases on the outer continental shelf. Under the MMS, the United States Mineral Management Service regulations, the assignment to parties are required to be approved by the MMS. There's no issue raised by Siegel in this case as to whether the assignment to the two assignments to Nortex were valid. In that situation, Justice Heck, if I'm pronouncing it correctly,
yes.
In that situation, the MMS would look at whether or not the receiving party was the shell company that your hypothetical provides and would not approve the assignment. In this situation, you have it being sold at an auction where all of the bidders are pre-qualified. Very important. Nortex and the briefs by Siegel have suggested an insolvent party. The auction was in the summer of 96.
That doesn't answer the question. I mean, assume that everything is pre-approved, there are no problems with any of these people, and they still file bankruptcy. What's the answer to Justice Heck's question?
The clear answer is that's the bargain that the parties entered into. And that's really what, from a policy implication, Justice Medina, is so important. The policy issue is if the parties freely bargain, as recognized by the Court of Appeals, to allocate the risk at the inception. You know, this operating agreement was drafted at the inception by Siegel before Eland was on the scene. Eland was a post-participating interest owner. They came in the process down the chain. If they allocate that risk, the Court of Appeals recognizes, the jurisprudence of the state of Texas recognizes, and I would cite to the court the Heritage Bank case, the American Manufacturers Mutual case, and the Royalty Indemnity case, that the courts are to enforce the party's bargain. This case is clear as a bell.
Let me ask you another question about that. Do you think it is the law of Texas that contracting party, two parties in a contract, one assigns his interest to another. Generally speaking, do you think it is the law or not, that the assignor remains liable to his contracting party for the obligations under their agreement?
The law depends upon what the obligations were when, in this case, the assignor, Eland, comes into the picture. 8.1, and it's in...
And you think the obligations are to pay for the costs while I'm participating, while I've got part of the working interest.
Exactly. All right, and that's what the express language says. 8.1 says what the basis of the charges are. It says that you pay in proportion to your participating interest. When you go to the definition section, and these are all in the bench exhibits, when you go to the definition sections of 210, and it talks about participating interest, it specifically says based on ownership in the lease. So if you are not a current owner, as Eland was not as of July 1, 1996, under the express wording, you have no obligation to pay those costs. Now, in this case, the question was asked, I think, by you, Justice Heck, to Mr. Maines, well, this doesn't happen that often. I would suggest this happens more often, but the parties clearly recognize and follow the exact language in the agreement. We have in 8.6 the exact situation where the parties contemplated, well, what happens if a current participating interest owner does default? It tells you exactly what happens, that the remaining owners pick up proportionally that share and they have subrogation rights. It specifically does not say you go back in the chain. There was also a question, I think, by, I'm not sure, Justice Johnson maybe. How about the industry, it was you, Your Honor, the industry issue, if you are going to go back generations among the chain, is that not going to cause a problem for the industry? And I would say, contrary to what Mr. Mays, my esteemed counsel, said, it would cause real problems. Just take the situation of a bank coming to Elan Energy, deciding whether they want to loan them some money, and looking at all of the prior interest that Elan previously owned, trying to decide whether there is this contingent liability out there as a borrower. That's one problem. From an industry perspective, the important thing is knowing what the bargain is when you go into it. When the parties entered into this agreement, Elan clearly understood that when it was an owner, it was obligated to pay its proportionate share. If you don't have an ownership interest, and this is all endorsed by the Court of Appeals decision, all endorsed by the express wording of the contract, if you don't have an interest, you're not obligated to pay. There is testimony, it's in footnote 6 of our brief on the merits, where even Siegel's joint interest account, Mr. Tomaselli, the individual that was sending out the bills, he testified, if you don't have an interest, and I'm paraphrasing, but it's in footnote 6, if you don't have an interest, then you're not obligated to pay. The Court of Appeals recognized that the bargain that the parties struck for the risk allocation, I started this argument telling you that it's really an issue of risk allocation. How are you going to allocate the risk? In this contract, the parties allocated the risk that if you're an owner, you're obligated. If you're not an owner, you have no continuing obligation. That's what's wrong with the argument from Siegel's perspective, to suggest that Elan needs to be released from a continuing obligation. When Elan came in, as well as every other interest owner, they were only obligated for so long as they owned an interest.
Mr. Rosenblum, is there a conflict in terms between sections 8 and 14 of the contract and section 15.1, or sections 8 are silent and 15.1 specifically tells you how to get out of the contract?
I don't think there's any conflict at all, Justice Medina. It gives the parties, depending upon the circumstances, as I indicated in response
Justice Green.
To Justice Green's questions, depending upon the circumstance at the time when you want to get out, you have options. And again, the law of Texas is clear. We're going to enforce, the court should enforce, I urge this court to enforce the policy decision that they're going to enforce the parties' bargain that they entered into, not try to rewrite the contract. So depending upon the circumstance, Justice Medina, either you assign it or you can, in essence, buy your way out.
But didn't Elan have an opportunity to exercise withdrawal rights by the contract?
It certainly did.
And, I mean, that's an express provision of the contract. Why not just say that's how you get out?
That is one way to get out. But it's not the only way. The assignment, and even Siegel tells you today, Chief Justice Jefferson, that they're freely in support of free assignments. Elan put these properties in a package sale at an auction. Elan certainly hoped that they received a lot more consideration for it. If they were evaluating the circumstances, Mr. Chief Justice, at the time, realizing they were not going to get a substantial amount of funds, and balancing that with buying their way out, if you will, under that withdrawal section. And if they had foresight to know what was going to happen at the auction, maybe they would have done that, Justice Jefferson. But in this case, you don't have the foresight. And the pie chart, which is so important, shows that the economics of it, if Elon really was, as it's being accused of, attempting to dump the property at the end of its life, the pie chart completely refutes that. And if Elon knew that it was going to have production for a number of years, it may not have chose. Now, the facts here are Elon purchases, acquired these properties. It's in the record. These were offshore properties. They're different than onshore properties. And Elon's core business was not in the offshore. So it put these properties among many, many other properties. The auction, which happens all the time, there are clearinghouse auctions where there are hundreds of properties sold at one time, with parties looking at data rooms to evaluate whether they want to buy the properties. To a large extent, Justice Heck, the property is in the beauty of the eyes of the beholder. There could have been a situation where somebody bid on this property and paid a lot more money. Elon was not happy when they found out that they were forced to sell this property at this no minimum bid blind auction.
How are these disputes typically resolved?
Excuse me?
How are these type of disputes typically resolved? The disputes of whether or not you're responsible after an assignment. How are they resolved?
I would suggest two ways. If there's no language in the agreement between the parties bargaining, the general principle that Siegel is telling you to follow in the five cases would apply. But if the parties have specific language in their bargain, as we have here, the Court of Appeals recognized that this precise situation was contemplated. All right? Those cases cited for the general proposition, if you look at them, all of them say in one way or another, unless the agreement says otherwise. For example, in the Jones case, the assignee was granted summary judgment because it neither expressly or impliedly assumed the royalty payment obligations. Here, Nortex, Elon's assignee, expressly assumed those obligations. And when Elon came into the picture earlier on, it did so only to the extent it was while it was an owner. So the Jones case, which is one of the cases that Siegel cites for the general proposition, actually supports wholly Elon's position here. It depends upon the bargain. That's why the real policy implications here, and I recognize that your decision is beyond just this case. I'm here on behalf of Elon, but I recognize that what the court rules is beyond this case.
Well, let me ask you a question about that. Going back to this risk allocation thing that you mentioned. If Carl Rosenblum makes a lease with Paul Green, it says the lessee is obligated to pay on the lease. Paul Green assigns the lease later to Scott Brister, and he defaults. Because he is now the lessee, and I'm not, then your cause of action is against him and not me, but the default. Is that what you're saying?
No, sir. Justice Green, and it's very important, and I'm glad you asked me the question. Your hypothetical has the context of a lessor-lessee relationship. This operating agreement is not, and there is no party in this case dealing with the lessor. If I can, Your Honor, what I would suggest is if you have a son or daughter at college and three or four of them are sharing an apartment and they decide that, let's say there's four of them, they're each going to pay 25% of the rent to the landlord. It's not an issue between them and the landlord. It's an issue if one of the college students defaults, who's going to pick up that extra 25% of the rent? That's exactly, in essence, what this operating agreement did. It allocated the risk among the co-lessees. Your hypothetical, which brings in the lessor, is exactly why the reference to the restatement language that Mr. Maines brought to the court's attention, the reference to the treatise, the reference to the other scholars that are cited in the brief is completely inapplicable to these cases. Aside from the fact that in each one of those cases, let's take the MMS regulations because those are the regulations that would apply to these federal leases. The MMS regulations clearly say, and I'm at section 30 CFR 256.62. It says, you as a signer are liable for all obligations that accrue under your lease before the date that the regional director approves your request for the assignment of the record title in the lease. The regional director's approval of the assignment does not relieve you of accrued lease obligations. Number one, that's a lessor situation. But number two, it's specifically consistent with the way the parties agreed in the operating agreement. It's accrued obligations before the assignment. So if you have an assignment, as you have here, and it's approved, and there's no issue by Siegel about whether the assignments properly went to Nortex, these are all obligations post the assignment. That's why it's so important to recognize, number one, Justice Green, that we don't have a lessor-lessee relationship here, number one. And number two, there's no issue of whether Elan paid its obligations while it was an owner. That's what brings you back to the express wording of the agreement. That's what brings you back to the testimony of the Siegel witnesses that's in the record. Not the Elan witnesses, but the Siegel witnesses that are telling you what the industry custom and practice is. Now, I'm very well aware that you can't look out. I understand my time is up. Can I just finish my point?
Yes, complete your thought, please.
I'm very well aware that you can't look at parole evidence if you have a clear and unambiguous language to alter or vary. What we're suggesting is that the custom, industry, and practice evidence is completely consistent, and we have cited in our briefs the appropriateness to look at that custom and industry practice evidence when it's consistent to support the unambiguous language of the agreement. Thank you for your patience.
Thank you.
May it please the court, Mr. Bill Boyce will present the rebuttal presentation.
I did not hear Elan dispute the general contours of the restatement rules. Did not hear Elan dispute that that's part of Texas law. In terms of lessor-lessee relationships, it should be undisputed that this rule has been applied in a number of contexts, not just landlord-tenant, but, for example, in the Potts case, the Jones case, to patent rights. So it's not a landlord-tenant rule. What I hear Elan saying is that it depends on the contract. Depends on the particular circumstances. So let's look at the particulars of the contract. And I think it would be helpful for the court to compare and contrast two articles in the operating agreement, 14.3 against Article 26. 14.3 is the specific provision that governs assignments in the context of abandoning a well. And in that narrow, specific context, if the court looks at the operating agreement that's attached as tab 5 to our brief, 14.3 assignment of interest, at the very end of that paragraph, after talking about how the assignment works in the context of abandoning a well, it specifically says the party so assigning shall be relieved from any further liability with respect to said well. This illustrates our point. In that narrow circumstance, the contract expressly said if you have an assignment in the context of abandoning a well, then you are relieved. Compare that to Article 26, which is the general assignment provision governing assignments other than those arising in the context of abandoning a well, and there is no similar provision. Comes back to the questions Mr. Maines put it. Which way does the silence cut? Under Article 26, where the contract is silent, where the contract does not say to the assignor, your liability is terminated upon assignment, the silence cuts in favor of continuing liability, which is our main point. I think, too, if you focus on how this fits together with the other provisions of the contract, it makes sense. Reference was made to Article 8.6. The description offered of Article 8.6 was a little bit incomplete because if you look at it closely, it says that the operator has an option to seek payment from current interest owners for the unpaid costs. The specific language is upon operator's request. It's an option to go to the current interest owners. If it is an option to go to those current interest owners, that must mean that you have an option not to go to the current interest owners, i.e., you can go to prior interest owners who have made assignments if there's not express language cutting off their liability after the assignment. Siegel's interpretation.
It's a pretty broad interpretation of that.
I'm sorry?
That seems to be a pretty broad interpretation of that section of the contract.
But I think it comes back to the point of
which way does the silence cut? And if you look at 15.1, the withdrawal provision, plus 8.6, plus 14.3, which is the abandonment one that we just talked about, plus 26, I think what the court will see is that in specific narrow circumstances, assignments were dealt with for particular circumstances when there was an intent to cut off liability after the assignment. We're under kind of the catch-all provision of Article 26.1, and that is simply not there. The express language, consistent with the restatement position, cutting off assignor liability, is simply not there to be found. I would like to address a couple of points with respect to the industry custom and practice, which I really think is a red herring, and it's a red herring for a couple of reasons. Number one, the contract has been found to be unambiguous. We contend it's unambiguous. They contend it's unambiguous. I don't know that industry custom and practice has anything to say about this issue. But I think also when the court digs into the record sites that are offered in footnotes 6, 7, and 8 of Elan's brief, what the court is going to find is a couple of things. First, Mr. Maines objected. This is during the bench trial portion of the case. Recall that there was a partial summary judgment followed by a bench trial on damages and affirmative defenses. What the court will find, for example, at volume 3 of the reporter's record, pages 150 through 51 and 200 through 202, volume 4, page 115 and 16, is that we objected at the bench trial portion of this. Mr. Maines objected, saying, "Judge, they're trying to get behind your partial summary judgment. Don't let them do this. This is inappropriate. You've already ruled as a matter of law what the contract means." The response by Elan at trial was, "Oh, Judge, this goes to our affirmative defenses of waiver and estoppel, that sort of a thing." You'll find that at page 150 and 51 of volume 3 and 200 through 202. The affirmative defenses have not been briefed in this court. They were not reached in the Court of Appeals below. The court just went on the threshold partial summary judgment issue. Bottom line is the purported evidence of industry custom and practice was offered, according to Elan, for a purpose other than what we're here talking about today.
So what if instead of these facts, there's an assignment, and for the next 20 years, operator sends checks to the assignee, costs are paid by the assignee, and 20 years later, as it comes time to plug and abandon, and for then reasons completely unrelated, the assignee is now bankrupt. That would be a bit of a surprise for the assigner to then find out they're on the hook when everybody's been acting for 20 years as if they weren't.
Well, in terms of surprise, I think it comes down to the question of when you interpret the operating agreement against the settled restatement rules reflected in Texas, there should be no surprise. There should be an understanding that the assignor's liability continues into the future.
Is there no implied waiver for sending them checks to the assignee for 20 years and taking payment from the assignee for 20 years?
I would submit to the court that it's going to depend on the facts of any particular case, but if there's no indication that the assignee has ceased to live up to its obligations to pay its proportion of costs and so forth, that there would be, it would be a stretch to come up with a waiver situation under those circumstances. But, you know, let's look at it in terms of allocating risks. If the assignor looks to cut off its continuing liability, then it can ask for language similar to that which appears in Article 14.3, saying your liability ceases upon assignment. That's the article, that's the language that's missing here. And I want to underscore another point about reference to participating interests. I think what I hear Elan arguing is that we've got an express release, look at the participating interest language. And I would submit to the court that when you get right down to it, participating interest is how you do the math. It's how you compute that which is received under the operating agreement, that which is owed under the operating agreement. Participating interest does not address the completely separate question of if you're going to assign your interests away, do you have continuing liability or not? I think this is illustrated again by Article 14.3.
Well, Mr. Rosenblum indicated he understood it to be some subrogation right under that clause.
There may be there may be rights as between the assignor and the defaulting assignee to try to recoup rights. Certainly Eland tried to do that in this case. But I think what's interesting under 14.3 is it makes reference to the participating interest language that Eland has hung its case on to a very substantial degree. And yet, even in a clause that expressly references the participating interest in 14.3, you still have the express language in there that says, after your assignment in this abandonment context, your liability assignor is terminated. If all of this is bound up and answered by participating interest, and if participating interest appears in 14.3, then why do you need that extra statement in 14.3 that says the assignor's liability is cut off? If I may finish, the answer is because the question is addressed by language specifically addressing what happens to the assignor's liability, not by participating interest. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. The cause is submitted, and the court will take a brief recess.
All rise.